Time goes really slow on that side, but on this side it goes really fast. So if you notice, we had 25 minutes to talk on each one of those topics, 25 minutes. So when we sit down to talk, we have to figure out what are we not going to say, because we would love to just have 4 hours. But then what happens is when we figure out what we're not going to say, there's no way around it. We always forget something. So I want to know what Butters forgot this time. What did you leave out?
What did I leave out? Yeah, one of the things I think is important, going back way back to the first session of the day, which is about sexual addiction. And I talked, my part was talking about the neurochemistry and dopamine. How many of you were able to be in here? A few of y'all? Okay. I think this is the important part that I forgot to mention, which is significant, is that neurochemistry is not an excuse for behavior. It does not give somebody a free pass. It brings about the awareness that says, okay, now I actually need to be more aware and more responsible. And so just imagine somebody with diabetes sitting at a buffet eating just pouring sugar in. And you say, don't you have diabetes? Well, it's okay, I've got diabetes, I can do this. Well, how would that make any sense at all? And so when we say, well, I have an addiction, so that's why I'm doing this, I can't just help myself. It's not an excuse for behavior. It actually raises the level of responsibility that you have to have. I have an addiction, I need to be aware of this. What am I going to do to live my life in a way that's going to help me stay healthy, stay happy, stay connected to God, stay holy? And so, again, I just want to make sure, I think it's important that we understand the neurochemistry of it, because it plays a role. Hopefully the understanding of it will reduce some shame there, but it is not the devil made me do it or the dopamine made me do it. We still have to figure out what is my responsibility in this and then how do I go forward. So that was maybe the whole point of my stuff and I left it out. But anyway, what about you?
Okay. I think I left out a couple of major points and now I can't even remember what one of them is. So that's interesting. You'll have to come to one of our other.
You left the joke out.
I did leave the joke out. Should I tell the joke? Yeah. you know what's funny about the joke story is I told Ryan this morning that I cut the joke, and he said, oh, my dad told me that joke. So it just keeps floating around.
Yeah, it's,
so in my slide, I had the missing piece in Meets the Big O, and they were all like kind of stick figure drawings. And then I had the little, if it all comes together and you're rolling, then it ought to roll between the sheets too. And then it's kind of a dance, and it's kind of a tango. And then I was going to say, do you know why Church of Christers don't have sex standing up? Might lead to dancing. Yeah. So there you go. Glad you came back for the other part.
Yes.
Hope that was worthwhile. I quoted Esther Perel to answer Ryan's question. I quoted Esther Perel. She is amazing lady. She's Belgium. Speaks like 7 different languages. I do not. But anyway, one of the things that when she talks about the research that she's done on sexuality, the overwhelming research is not that people want more sex. People want better sex. And so then if you look at the presentation that Ryan and I gave, especially with Ryan and the funnels and this idea of making yourself more interesting and all of that, that concept, that piece is real important because, you know, the most important sex organ is here. And so if we're not cultivating that, it's kind of a big deal. We don't want more sex, we want better sex. And then if you have better sex, it lasts longer. So this is an R-rated workshop you've signed up for, so I'm just going to speak freely. But in this piece here on that, that's not to say there's not a place for a quickie, you know? Quickies have their place. But if you live on fast food, it's not good. And so there should be this sustainable sex that is deeper and richer and more important than two ships passing in the night, getting that quickie that's about getting some relief and that meaningful experience. So I think that's an important piece that I left out.
Well, we thank y'all for being in here, and if you've been to some of our other ones and you're in here now, then we consider you our tribe. Y'all are our people. Either that or you've come to kill our tribe. I'm not sure perhaps which one. I guess there's a couple options. But we just want to thank y'all for coming again. Jim, I always say Jim and I real quick, and it sounds like Gemini instead of Jim and I, but anyway, Jim and I have very strong beliefs and opinions about this topic of sexuality, of same-sex attraction. We didn't come to them just overnight or just because Dad, who my dad's sitting over here, or even my mom, told me so. But that being said, some of this, the why it's of such importance to me is because I have wrestled and tried to figure it out and have sat with people that have been trying to figure it out and have been in that process of coming to own it, own my belief system. And so there's going to be some of these questions that we're going to allow you to continue to own for yourself. And so we're not trying to dodge any questions. We're not going to dodge them. But at the end of this, whatever you walk out of here with, you're going to be responsible for you. You're responsible for you. And we may be 100% wrong about something, or we may be 100% right. But as Jim said at the very end of that last presentation, he doesn't feel like he's going to be judged on whether I get the topic right, but about how I respond to people with this topic. How am I living this out? That's the important part. So with that being said, why don't we just open up for some questions, and we'll go from there.
First of all, thank you. I've been in all three of your sessions, and now you're part of my tribe, too.
Awesome. Thank you.
Should always be done in love with the bookends that you so eloquently put together this afternoon. I talked to the gentleman and I said, you know, when it comes to the Matthew 18, if you're in that Matthew 18 situation, you go talk to a person, they won't listen to you, then you bring two or three others, they won't do. I said, this process could take months or years, right? If you're working with somebody. He said, well, no, it shouldn't take that long. So the question I have for you is this. When someone has a sexual addiction and they How do you know when to draw the line to repentance and recovery, or the guy's just not trying, or the girl's just not trying? Then when do you know it's time to take action as shepherds, other than to pray and work with them and, you know, cry with them and spend time with them? Where's the line there? How can you identify the line? I guess is what I'm asking.
Let me ask a question just real quick. What would be an action of the shepherd that you're referring to?
Well, to know to go from trying to assist them in recovery to try and tell them that what you're doing is now open defiance to God, and we can't tolerate that in the church because then that sends a bad image to everybody else that we're just allowing you to continue in open sin.
Sure. You've taken the first one or me?
I teach an adult Bible class, and this past summer we did a study on 1st, 2nd, and 3rd John, which is going to direct us back to confronting in love. One of the slides that I cut from my presentation is a triangle that a group called the Arbinger Group has put together for a book they call The Anatomy of Peace. And in the triangle, there's five layers of helping things go right. So the first one is I've got to kind of step out of my judgment, not objectify the person, not see the person as a problem, but see the person as a person with a problem. Then I've got to keep my own heart at peace. And then I've got to figure out how can I have an influence on the people that are around that person. And then I've got to figure out how to have relationship with that person, like I talked about in the last presentation with Mary Duncan, that went above and beyond the call of duty for me. And then finally, I get to listen and learn about them. And when I've done all of that, I have not only earned the privilege to confront them, but I have earned the responsibility as a Christian brother to confront them. But there's a whole lot of me doing what's right, helping things go right. Because here's the thing, like if it comes down to a disfellowshipping, okay?
Well, that would be a last resort.
Yeah, but if it went all the way to the ultimate thing, if I have no deep, meaningful relationship with those people, they've done nothing. But if I love those people and I would die for those people and they are so desperately wanting me to see that I'm in error, then that's going to throw that dynamic totally different. So then that's not weeks or years. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, I guess the question is, how do you know when to identify when they've given up on recovery and repentance and they're just going to go ahead and live in the open defiance?
Yeah.
How do you identify that
point? I'm going to switch it one more time, a little judo move, okay? You've got somebody that is morbidly obese. I don't see us doing that with those people. You've got somebody who is a gossip and they're poisoning your congregation. I don't see us doing it with those people.
They're very deadly.
So I think what we've got to start looking at in this is not making this one sexual sin outside of the circle of this. And so we've got to see it for what it is. If we have relationship with them and we are, I guess the best thing I can come up with, last Christmas, so not this past Christmas, but the Christmas before, Lou said politics, so I'm just going to jump into politics. I was at a Christmas party, and I overheard people talking about me. It's kind of weird. And they're discussing who might be candidates. And somebody brought up Al Gore might be a candidate. Now, remember, that's quite a while ago. And they said Jim Gallion wouldn't vote for Al Gore. And I've never said anything about Al Gore one way or the other. And the other person in the circle that was having this conversation said, why is that? And they said, he divorced his wife when she had a mental illness. And so he wouldn't vote for him. Now, I've never talked about Al Gore. I've never talked about politics with these people. But if people know me, they know some things about me that count. And so we don't have to cram our beliefs down somebody else. If we can see that we're in relationship with them and they know how we feel and believe, they're going to alter that behavior or they're not going to be around us. Because health attracts health, health repels unhealth. And so there's something attractive about that healthy relationship. So how do you know when they're in recovery? How do you know when they're out of recovery? Well, if they're trying, they're in recovery, and you can tell. This is the thing, it makes me crazy. If I'm working with a spouse of a drug addict or a parent of a drug addict, they all want to talk about the pee in the cup. That's what they want to talk about. Can the kid pee in the cup? Can the husband pee in the cup? That's what they want to know. Is it going to pass? I don't need a cup to tell me if you are doing well. If your whole life looks good, pee in the cup, don't pee in the cup, who cares? But if you pee in the cup and you pass the drug test, but your whole life is just junk, it doesn't matter. So what you want to see is you want to see an upward progression, not perfection, but an upward progression so that they are making progress in their recovery. And then you can support that. You can encourage that. You don't want to enable the unhealthy behavior. That's the thing.
What'd you say? Yeah, I would add.
I just wanted to add something. The slide you had up this morning I thought was very appropriate, which said recovery is caught, not taught. And we just don't know when that young man or that young woman is going to catch it. And in the meantime, you know, we keep teaching them. I've known young men who've been in recovery programs for 6 or 7 different times, and they've been taught it, and they've been taught it, and they've been taught it, to the point that they can teach it. But until they catch it, until they're ready to make the commitment, all the teaching in the world, I mean, it helps. And you're right, they have to make those steps along the way. You can see the progress sometimes. And I had one young man tell me one time, I've been to 6 or 7 different programs, and I've learned something from every one of them. And they do it until they catch it.
I would say this, and this may get me in trouble. It has nothing to do with the topic itself. So I apologize for offending anybody that sells Plexus. Okay, but this may be an issue. But I have some friends that sell Plexus, and it is a health product. And they talk about Plexus so much that I know that there have been some other people that have backed away from them on Facebook and other stuff because it is just overwhelming. It has consumed their life. If I'm interested in Plexus, then I'll go hang out with them. If I'm not, then I'm going to back away. And so one of the things I think that that we figure out is not, is he in recovery or she in recovery, but am I in recovery? Am I following God? Am I doing what's right? And is that exuding out of me? Because if it is, if that is who I am, if that is my identity, then people that are not in recovery, that don't want to be, that are in open defiance, will not want to be around me. It will be so uncomfortable for them. And usually, the more love you show them, the more mercy that's there, the more they struggle with that and the more they distance themselves from you and run away from that. When we come in with what seems like a more judgmental approach or isolating approach, it's not going to be the answer. Relationship is going to be the answer. It's really hard to be in a relationship if I say, you can't be in my tribe until you're good enough to be there. That was not Jesus's message. He came while we were still sinners. He came when we were at our worst spot. And so I'll go back to this one thing that Jim talked about when we overcomplicate things. Recovery basically is being honest, it's being humble, and being willing to tell the story of you and God together and the progress that you're making. If they're willing to do that, part of the story may be I relapsed last night, and you are welcome to be right here. But if it's, I'm going to lie to you constantly, I'm going to deny every bit of it, then you're probably not going to want to hang out with me anyway, because it's not going to jive, it's not going to be there, and I don't have to draw a hard line. It's the way that it naturally unfolds. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah, Grayson.
In your genderbread diagram, you sort of broke down a lot of facets involved in this discussion to different sort of things like gender expression, gender identification, and things like that. And the way that you presented those, each of them was illustrated with a spectrum, a sort of a line going left and right. And that's how a lot of people think about gender today, informed by things from the natural world, whether it be in the animal kingdom or certain things that we see with human beings being born with both sexual organs and different things like that. So my question is, to what extent do you view gender as a construct, and how does that inform your views on same-sex attraction, both in terms of living out one's Christian faith consistently and in terms of from a counseling perspective?
Well, it is. In the therapy room, when we're dealing with any type of issue, it's always on a spectrum. Always on a spectrum. Which means there used to be this concept of autism, and they would say there are different levels of autism, right? We may all know that. And then depending on where you're at, you may have a more difficult or debilitating version of it. And so everything that we look at really has to do with a spectrum issue. Is gender on the spectrum? Absolutely. I think we have to pull ourselves back out of a place that says, this is a man, and this is what a man thinks, and this is what a man does, and this is how a man acts, and this is just who it is. And if he doesn't think, act like this, then he's not a man. And this is a woman, and this is her role, and this is where she should be, and everything. So if it's a girl that likes sport, she's a tomboy. No, she's a girl. Okay, and then we can look at it on the spectrum from that angle. As far as I think where that comes in to be an issue is with our judgment of people's expression of how they view themselves. And so if it's a girl that's playing sports, or if it's a guy that likes to cook or whatever may be considered less manly, then we have this judgment that is there sending them a message of shame that basically says you're not who you're supposed to be. And then they're starting to wrestle with this idea of, okay, who am I really? Can I fully and truly be me in the presence of you? So keep coming to me with your question. What specifically are you shooting for there?
I guess maybe what I'm getting at is bluntly stated would be more what is the basis for delineating certain expressions of attraction as Christian or as of God and others not, if it is indeed rooted in such a construct as you're kind of expressing. I mean, is it basically, let's look at Romans 1, let's look at 1 Corinthians and that sort of thing, or do you think there's something else in play?
Can I have a swing at that one?
Sure.
I'm hearing what you're saying. Who's the guy who does Wired for Intimacy? What's his name?
I can't remember.
Okay, so there's this neuroscientist. I can't remember his name right now. It's Wired for Intimacy. Anybody ever read that book? It was a huge... He's a Christian neuroscientist, and he teaches at Wesleyan University. And I'm just drawing a blank. Somebody can look it up on their smartphone. But anyway, I went to a conference on his on this topic. And what he said is, in what we've done is we've turned this into a dichotomy. And we've said there is black and there is white, there is male and there is female. And because of the time that I went to this conference, this was funny and timely. He said, no, there's more 50 Shades of Grey. Okay? And so what's the guy's name?
Struthers.
Okay, he is also a very handsome, short guy with a gray beard. And but anyway, what his point was, because he's a Christian, is he says we are magically and neurologically designed within that spectrum. And so am I living up to my God-based potential where I am in the spectrum? And it's how I am designed rather than trying to force myself to be something that I'm not. And so then within that design, and guys, this is going to be a snarky statement, so just keep all the grace flowing this direction. But the book that has made me more clients and more money of than all time is His Needs, Her Needs. Because people, they know, well, now they know my needs and they won't make them, and now I'm going, you know. But what I love is when the couple comes in that has read that book, the husband will often say, well, I'm the woman in the relationship. Okay. The whole thing is messed up. Because what we're saying is, this is the type of person that I am, and this is the type of person that I'm married to. And sometimes I'm the woman in my relationship, and sometimes my wife has got some very manly attributes and it's kind of sexy. It works for her. And at other times, she's very feminine. And so we have got to figure out what we're okay with that, and then figure out, who did God create me to be? That's why I did the whole, who am I really? Who am I within, how did God create me to be, and can I lean into that in all aspects of my life? And I think we get over, I know we talked all day about sex, but we get over funneled on sex. There's more to life than just my sex. Am I being true to who God created me to do in every aspect of my life? And so I hope that's answering the question, because what we're saying is there is a spectrum, and you can be anywhere on the spectrum and still be godly, I think. Would you say that?
Yeah, absolutely.
We don't always agree.
Yes, sir.
You can't hear
we
them?
We do. Are they not on? Mine's on a little bit. Right, all right. You have to yell out. Is there another question? Yes. Sure. 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 Yeah, this is a little bit of a longer answer, but I'm going to give it to you. The arousal template, everybody has one. Everybody has one. The arousal template that I was talking about this morning, that may be where somebody had basically experiences with the same sex, either through pornography, through abuse, or whatever, that then forms their arousal template, and they then live that out, is not everybody that would say they are homosexual. That is not everybody's story. But it is a large number of people that I have dealt with specifically. One of the tricky parts about it is when your first experiences are that way, or with the same sex, either through pornography, which is becoming more prevalent that way, or through abuse type situations, or just the culture just kind of bombarding you with this image, it starts to become all you know about sex. And so I've had a lot of people that will say, I've been this way since birth. And then through the conversation, I think what they figure out is, I've been this way since I started to understand sexuality. Meaning the first times I was aroused, it was through a same-sex experience. And they really don't remember when they were born, right? And so they're starting to have this arousal template formation. And then what do you do about that? Well, there's a few things that can be done. Like I said, with the language concept, you're not going to forget English, but you can learn a new language. And so that is not true when it comes to the arousal template for everybody. What I'm saying is, again, I had L.V. Pfeiffer up there, and my point with that is, if he's been attracted to women his whole life and only women, at what point is he going to pray enough that all of a sudden he's just attracted to men? Did I say that right?
Yeah, got it right.
How all of a sudden would he start becoming attracted to the sex he's not attracted to? It's a very difficult prospect. One of the things that happens is that, and this would be, if we were the most LGBTQ affirmative therapist, there was one named Rob Weiss, who's in our field, who would tell you what I'm about to tell you. That there are some people that are heterosexual, that because of their wounds, their experiences, their trauma, their arousal templates, have formed an attraction to the same sex, that when you go back and you do the trauma work there, it will begin to relieve some of those symptoms, and you will be able to be more fully aroused by the opposite sex. It's as if they are trying to, I hate to use the word repair because it's a loaded word in our field, but they are trying to heal from some of those wounds. And so they would tell us as therapists, when somebody comes in, you have to figure out, is this person gay or is this person straight who's acting out in a homosexual way? If they're gay, then you help them figure out that they're gay and you help them be okay with that. This is what they would tell us. But if they're straight but they're acting out in a gay way, then you help them heal the wounds that got them to be acting out that way, and then everything will be hunky-dory. And so there is some possibility that if you go back and you heal some of the wounds, that will resolve itself for some people. That is certainly not everybody. Certainly not everybody. And then I would ask you this, and I'll go back to diabetes. If I eat myself into diabetes, meaning I had a little bit of a control over the situation or the experiences that got me there, at what point am I no longer diabetic because I changed my eating habits or whatever? It may be under control, but I'm still diabetic. And so it doesn't, just because you go back and do the trauma work doesn't always change the arousal template. In fact, it doesn't change it. You have to add to it.
Let me jump in there. There's something for a long time that has been thought that is just way off. And that's that when he was talking about reparative therapy or aversion therapy, you guys may remember 20 years ago, I don't have a good sense of time, but guys would wear giant rubber bands around their wrist, and then if they wanted to break this lust pattern, they'd snap, you know. Yet that doesn't work. In fact, aversion therapy, anybody watch Downton Abbey? Okay, so in a Downton Abbey, there was a character that was one of the things that he wanted so desperately to not be gay, and so he sent off for this kit to un-gay himself, and he was going to poison and destroy his body trying to change this arousal template. Well, that's not how it works. You can't add negativity and make this thing change. So I always go back to a story. I think this is just the coolest story ever. I had a client that was a trauma victim. They had been in a kidnapping. The person they were with got shot. So none of this case has anything to do with sex. But I get a full history on this guy. And this is what he comes up with. In first grade, he had learning disabilities. And he failed first grade, but he went to a little country school. And he was the only kid who got held back in first grade. So he quickly picks up the name, the nickname, Retard. Okay? In second grade, so he makes it through first grade again. He gets to second grade. He has what he says is a pretty redheaded teacher. She was right out of college, and she made him her project. By the time this kid was in fourth grade, he was in gifted and talented and graduated as salutatorian of his high school. Now, at the ripe old age of 24, what color hair does his wife have? Could she have anything else? The arousal template is completely set. There was nothing sexual that happened between that second grader and his teacher. But a woman changed his life, and she had red hair. And everything from that point on is moving in that direction. Now, if he had dated a redhead in high school and she would have broke his heart, we might be having a different wife ending. But I think this arousal template, we often look at it from same sex, this arousal template, when he said it's happening to everybody, everybody in here's got an arousal template. You know what you think is attractive.
Yeah, and the other part of that is, There's kind of a classic example that Pat Carnes uses of a child that was growing up in an abusive household. And his father would routinely get drunk and be physically violent with his wife, the boy's mom. And what he did as a kid is he would go and hide when that stuff would happen. This makes sense, right? You would go and hide. Well, as he got older, he started to find out about masturbation and how that helped him escape life and how he escaped worry and stress and all those kind of negative feelings he didn't want to experience. And so then what would happen as he got a little bit older and had discovered masturbation, when dad would start beating his wife, his mom, the boy would go and hide in his closet and then masturbate, basically doing this, I don't want to hear it, I don't want to hear it, I don't want to be here, I don't want to be here. Well, all that pressure and all that stress is still coming into his body as he's trying to figure out how to be aroused. And then he came into therapy because he could not be aroused anymore without violence being a part of the sexual equation. He wasn't trying to do that. It wasn't something that he chose to think, yeah, I think violence is going to be sexy. But it is part of the experience. In our field, we talk about the neurons, the parts of our brain that fire together, wire together. And so under stress, under duress, I'm going to use something sexual in order to take care of it. So what do I start feeling when stress shows up? I start feeling sexual. They start becoming woven together. And so the arousal template doesn't matter who we are. It's all been woven together with experiences that help form what we feel, what we think, what we're attracted to, what we're aroused by. But I'm telling you that you didn't have any choice over the formation of it. It began before you could even understand what it was talking about. Just like we talked about with English. You started speaking English before you could read it or write it, right? The same thing with the arousal template. But if things have come along that have been negative, and basically negative means it is hurting you in relationship with other people, then we all have to figure out, how do I adapt? How do I change? What do I do with this? Because it is hurting me, or it's hurting the person that I love. Again, we don't get to say, well, this is my arousal template, so you just have to deal with it because this is what is arousing to me. There may be people that would go out and rape or maim or hurt and say, that's just my arousal template. Okay, but what are we going to do now to figure out how to have a healthy expression of sexuality? How are we really going to have a healthy expression? And so that's kind of long answers there. There are things that you can do to be helpful, but I am convinced, and have experienced some people that arousal template, whether again, and it doesn't matter really from this argument's sake, whether you believe it was there from birth genetically or if it was strictly experiential through arousal template, that it is so ingrained that they are not going to be able to change it. It is there. We know that it is changeable because pornography has changed it. Tolerance increases it, but it doesn't increase it towards health. It always increases it towards unhealth, towards the creation of more dopamine or the attempt, which is why they go to bestiality or to children or other things like this, where it's beginning to become more extreme.
Could you clarify or differentiate between a homosexuality and same-sex attraction, and also the varying levels of same-sex attraction, like Kinsey 1-5, you know, sort of stuff? Like, can you, people who are attracted to both, like, can they have happy, healthy sexual lives with their partners, stuff like that?
Sure.
Go ahead, I'll let you go first.
Okay. What was the first part of the question?
Well, that was from your part of the...
Same-sex attraction and homosexuality.
Yeah.
That's from your presentation, yeah. So I'll let you have first.
I think you have to define what they mean to you, okay? Because some people are going to, and I'm not trying to split hairs here, but some people will say he's homosexual and it means this is his identity. This is how he identifies himself. This is genetically the way that he is, and there's no outside influences at all. It's just genetic. And then there are some that just say homosexual, meaning this is the attraction that he has. To me, the Christian world has grabbed same-sex attraction instead of the word homosexual, kind of like we do pro-choice and pro-life. Because everybody wants to be pro, nobody wants to be anti. And so we're trying to figure out how do we say same-sex attraction, when really I think they're, generally speaking, they're going to be the same thing. It's going to be about the attraction to whatever gender you're attracted to. And so we would say I'm heterosexual, I'm attracted to the opposite sex, I'm homosexual, I'm attracted to the same sex, or I'm same-sex attracted, I'm attracted to the same sex. Yeah, that, I mean,
that's that sliding spectrum.
That's going to be that spectrum a little bit with Grayson.
But you would say that those people are homosexual. You would say that they're heterosexual if they're on that half of it?
Well, again, it just comes back to, are you defining it as somebody who's acting out
right.
the behavior or somebody who's not?
You consider them to be the same. So I would say that in that situation, they would be very different.
Different in what way are you saying?
Homosexuality and same-sex attraction.
But different how?
Because one of them is...
identifies as heterosexual.
Right, but still experiences same-sex attraction.
Some, yes.
I
actually have a client right now that falls into that zone, and it is a very confusing spot to be. He is male, he identifies as heterosexual, and yet he has sometimes, because, you know, it's not like he's attracted to all men, but there will be something that will spark that arousal in him sometimes, and it freaks him out a little bit. And so we've been working with that because he's wanting to get this thing put away. Like he's trying to help himself make sense of it. So then, trying to think, this is Motown song, but we're talking about A Darker Shade of Gray. Remember that? Anyway, I'm old. There's this gray spectrum. And so if you think about it, it's not black or white, it's hi-fi grays. There's all these sort of shades of gray. And so up until the midpoint, you may be, from the black side, you may be a darker shade of gray, but still be heterosexual with some tendencies to that. Yeah, and then from the other, it'd be the other way. Here's the part that's really confusing. When you've got somebody who comes in and they truly are bisexual, for them, they're in a special kind of confusing, agonizing spot. And maybe folks don't know this, but in the gay community, they've been the last to be accepted to the party. So they're kind of the outcast, which is hard. So it's like the Jewish woman that, by the way, when she said that at that conference, no one did anything. Maybe you weren't there for the earlier presentation, but we were at a conference, and a woman approached the microphone and posed some questions. She identified as lesbian. She's a very devout Jewish woman. And so she was not accepted by either one. Well, that's what happens sometimes in the bi community too. So they've got attractions that go both ways, and they are confused by that, and they almost feel two of them that I've worked with almost feel like they're deviants. Am I just sick? You know, is this just part of my illness? And so there's a, because of that sliding scale, they're more confused by that place. Does that help? Okay.
Yeah, one of the things I would say as I was trying to wrap my mind around what you're asking is, when I talk about homosexual or same-sex attracted, I'm talking about specifically the attraction to the opposite sex. Whether if they have some of both, I would go to the bisexual term and say, okay, you're experiencing attraction and arousal by both sex. Now, there's going to be a spectrum on each of those. And then ultimately, when somebody comes in and they're talking about these kind of, it comes into therapy, rarely is it helpful to figure out the label for them.
Right.
It's just, who are you? And then the sexual component, we'll figure that out. But who do you identify as? What do you feel? Who are you attracted to? What are you aroused by? And whether that ends up being heterosexual, bisexual, asexual, you name it. Is this kind of the starting place there?
The therapy approach that I like to take when that comes up is I talk about it in parts. So we actually pull up extra chairs and let the person move around from chair to chair. So they'll get in this chair and they'll say, okay, this is the part of me that sometimes gets attracted to males. And then we'll get up and have them change chairs and then have them have a conversation with themselves and, you know, move back and forth. Because what's happening is there's a fracturing going on within the person. They're in this cognitive dissident place where they're in battle with themselves. And so what we want to do is we want to integrate the person. If they can have that conversation. And one guy looked at me and he said, you're trying to make me schizophrenic, aren't you? And I said, no, just the opposite. Because those integration of parts makes the person whole. It's when they're at battle with each other, they're just going to get sicker and they're going to hide and it'll be secretive and it's just messed up. And so that's the approach I like to take. And I see progress with that, if I can get them to play along. And most do.
Some other questions? Yeah.
You mentioned it a lot this morning, the concept of catching recovery. And I've kind of been wondering, what does that look like? More, like, maybe tangible is not the word I'm looking for, but that's the word I got.
Sure.
I'm glad you asked. That one's mine. I'm kind of fond of that. It's because I didn't get it for a long time. And when you have, like the fellow was saying about the recovery guy who knows way more about recovery than, and he still can't do the recovery. There was a giant in recovery field from Little Rock, Arkansas, had a sixth grade education. He had spoken 52 countries on recovery, so he did okay. His name's Joe McHugh. And Joe would say, the trick ain't stopping. The trick is staying stopped. And so this catching thing, well, there was another guy, his name is Tversky, and Jewish guy, went the long way around to becoming a psychiatrist. He was a Jewish rabbi and then eventually found his way around to psychiatry. And what he says is there's markers for addictive thinking. That's another presentation that we sometimes do. And the person who thinks in an addictive way, they have a distorted thinking process. So the first marker of addictive thinking is black and white, all or nothing. So addicts are like, hair on fire or I'm out. That's number one. But there's these markers of addiction. So the way you catch it is you catch a new way of thinking. So even the way our brain fires, it fires, they call this top down, it's front to back, but they call it top down. It goes like this. And then when we have an aha moment, the current goes from ear to ear. Well, each time we stack those aha moments on each other, there's plasticity to the brain and we start thinking more healthy. So when Ryan talked about the addiction, it remanifests itself. At Chuck E. Cheese, you ever played Whack the Mole? That's how addiction works. So the mole pops up and it's sex addiction. And you get your big whacker and you wham! And then for the sex addict, the thing that pops up next, does anybody know what it would be? It's food. They tend to go together. And so then you whack the food and then workaholism pops up. And you whack that and it just keeps remanifesting unless you change the way you think. So you hear all these stories about, well, he was an alcoholic until he was 45 and then he just put away the bottle. Yeah, he is still an alcoholic. He's just an angry one because he has still got all of that addictive thinking going on in his head. In fact, if you want to know the saddest story of all, is meet an alcoholic who never found the bottle. See, the bottle became the solution because they had that alcoholic thinking all along. And then they become an alcoholic and they get to fix the problem. But if you have all of that addictive, unhealthy thinking and you don't catch the new way of thinking, you just keep getting more and more angry. You start self-loathing, self-pity, and you start lying because you don't want to have to tell the truth anymore because you're failing, and it just gets heavier and heavier and heavier. And so catching it would be to have this, I get it, what we call in recovery a spiritual experience, a moment of clarity. Yeah.
Okay. Yes, sir.
The fellow in Downton Abbey, if he came to you and wanted you to help him with his thinking problem, what kind of therapy would you do for him or with him?
Do you watch Downton Abbey?
I do.
Okay. Good question.
Yeah, that character needs a lot of help.
That's what I was thinking, because yeah. There's layers to that guy.
Well, again, you know, I think most importantly, what works in therapy it doesn't matter the issue. And this is research done about what is beneficial for therapy. What actually changes things is a relationship. Relationship is what makes a difference. And so if they come in, doesn't matter the issue, but in this case, that character, and I educate him and I inform him about sexuality, and that's the extent of it, or he feels judged, or he feels like he's gonna have to do X, Y, or Z in order to be okay, or whatever it is, if that's the message that's being sent, then nothing is gonna change. And so relationship is what I'm after from the moment that they walk in the door. If he came in, and really the way that it works is I just try to get to know them, which is not just the them that they want me to know, it is the them that they really are, or the them that they believe that they are. And so we do a lot of history taking to figure out what trauma has been there. If somebody is coming in for a sexual issue, there's going to be trauma there, either trauma that they've experienced in childhood or trauma that it is manifesting itself and it's not going real well in life at the moment. And so there was going to be work done on that trauma. So trying to understand again, what is his arousal template? What does he believe about sexuality? Ultimately, what does he believe about God and sexuality? How do they go together? And how does he see himself, his future? What would the concept of him living out a healthy lifestyle be for him?
Another piece of this that we have left out of this presentation, and if we're doing this like where we do a series of them, we do a whole thing just on this one topic. A sexual addiction is not defined as sexual addiction. It's defined as an intimacy disorder. And so every single sex addict, their diagnosis is not sex addiction. They have an intimacy disorder.
Intimacy
disorder.
And which is not about sex, it's about connection. And relationship.
So if you take people who have, if it's a classic sex addiction, what's really going on there is when they were a child, almost always, they had an attachment disorder. So there's some complications, like you've heard about reactive attachment, there's some complications about how they connect. So these people who the biggest solution is to create that attachment, like, The opposite of addiction is not recovery. The opposite of addiction is relationship and connection. And so what happens is these people, they're the hardest people in the world to connect with. Like, they got issues. And so the thing they need is connection and relationship, and people don't want to have to connect with them. And so then this is that weird paradigm that it's paradoxical that this is happening, because the solution is the thing that's hardest. So then these guys, the reason that they're so tearful is the people that they long to connect with the most, like their spouse, are the ones they have the hardest time connecting with. And so then as a therapist, in a lot of ways, we act as a surrogate. We're the one that if they can connect with us, they might be able to take this out and connect somewhere else. And so there's an object relations therapy component to this that dynamic has to walk out the door with them. So if we can duplicate in session what they can get to walk out the door, they're probably going to make it. That's why group is so important.